Tonight's reading is 1 Kings chapter 18, and we're actually going to read the whole chapter, beginning at verse 1. After many days, the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, "Go, show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain upon the earth." So Elijah went to show himself to Ahab. Now the famine was severe in Samaria, and Ahab called Obadiah, who was over the household. Now Obadiah feared the Lord greatly, and when Jezebel cut off the prophets of the Lord, Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by fifties in a cave, and fed them with bread and water. And Ahab said to Obadiah, "Go through the land to all the springs of water and to all the valleys. Perhaps we may find grass and save the horses and mules alive, and not lose some of the animals." So they divided the land between them to pass through it. Ahab went in one direction by himself, and Obadiah went in another direction by himself. And as Obadiah was on the way, behold, Elijah met him. And Obadiah recognized him and fell on his face and said, "Is it you, my lord Elijah?" And he answered him, "It is I. Go, tell your lord, behold, Elijah is here." And he said, "How have I sinned that you would give your servant into the hand of Ahab to kill me? As the Lord your God lives, there is no nation or kingdom where my Lord has not sent to seek you. And when they would say, 'He is not here,' he would take an oath of the kingdom or nation that they had not found you. And now you say, 'Go, tell your Lord, behold, Elijah is here.' And as soon as I have gone from you, the Spirit of the Lord will carry you I know not where. And so when I come and tell Ahab, and he cannot find you, he will kill me, although I, your servant, have feared the Lord from my youth. Has it not been told, my lord, what I did when Jezebel killed the prophets of the Lord, how I hid 100 men of the Lord's prophets by fifties in a cave and fed them with bread and water? And now you say, 'Go tell your lord, behold, Elijah is here,' and he will kill me." And Elijah said, "As the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand, I will surely show myself to him today." So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. When Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, "Is it you, you troubler of Israel?" And he answered, "I have not troubled Israel, but you have, and your father's house, because you have abandoned the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals. Now, therefore, send and gather all Israel to me at Mount Carmel, and the 450 prophets of Baal, and the 400 prophets of Asherah, who eat at Jezebel's table." So Ahab sent to all the people of Israel and gathered the prophets together at Mount Carmel. And Elijah came near to all the people and said, "How long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him." And the people did not answer him a word. Then Elijah said to the people, "I, even I only, am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Let two bulls be given to us, and let them choose one bull for themselves, and cut it in pieces and lay it on the wood, but put no fire to it. And I will prepare the other bull and lay it on the wood, and put no fire to it. And you call upon the name of your God, and I will call upon the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by fire, he is God." And all the people answered, "It is well spoken." Then Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, "Choose for yourselves one bull and prepare it first, for you are many, and call upon the name of your God, but put no fire to it." And they took the bull that was given them, and they prepared it, and called upon the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, "O Baal, answer us." But there was no voice, and no one answered. And they limped around the altar that they had made. And at noon Elijah mocked them, saying, "Cry aloud, for he is a god. Either he is musing, or he is relieving himself, or he's on a journey, or perhaps he is asleep and must be awakened." And they cried aloud and cut themselves after their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. And as midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation. But there was no voice. No one answered, no one paid attention. Then Elijah said to all the people, "Come near to me." And all the people came near to him. And he repaired the altar of the Lord that had been thrown down. Elijah took 12 stones according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord came, saying, "Israel shall be your name." And with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord. And he made a trench about the altar as great as would contain 2 seahs of seed. And he put the wood in order and cut the bull in pieces and laid it on the wood. And he said, "Fill 4 jars with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood." And he said, "Do it a second time." And they did it a second time. And he said, "Do it a third time." And they did it a third time. And the water ran round the altar and filled the trench also with water. And at the time of the offering of the oblation, Elijah the prophet came near and said, "O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and that I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their hearts back." Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, "The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God." And Elijah said to them, "Seize the prophets of Baal. Let not one of them escape." And they seized them. And Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slaughtered them there. And Elijah said to Ahab, "Go up, eat and drink, for there is a sound of the rushing of rain." So Ahab went up to eat and drink. And Elijah went up to the top of Mount Carmel, and he bowed himself down on the earth and put his face between his knees. And he said to his servant, "Go up now, look towards the sea." And he went up and looked and said, "There is nothing." And he said, "Go again," 7 times. And at the 7th time he said, "Behold, a little cloud like a man's hand is rising from the sea." And he said, "Go up, say to Ahab, prepare your chariot and go down, lest the rain stop you." And in a little while the heavens grew black with clouds and wind, and there was a great rain. And Ahab rode and went to Jezreel. And the hand of the Lord was on Elijah, and he gathered up his garment and ran before Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel.
So you might like to keep the passage open before you, so you can follow along during the talk. And also the handout that was in the server sheet might help you to follow along where we're going, or take notes if you wish to. It's with the death last year of Joe Frazier, who's one of the world's best boxers, I was reminded of some of the biggest moments in boxing. You know, in particular, in October 1974 in Zaire, when Muhammad Ali took on George Foreman in the Rumble in the Jungle, regarded as the greatest boxing contest ever. It attracted worldwide attention as Foreman, the hard-hitting, powerful world champion, was taking on the quicker but the older Muhammad Ali. And when it came to boxing, nothing was bigger than this. It was unprecedented prize money. It was unprecedented interest from all around the world. And everything was at stake. And as Ali knocked Foreman down for the count in the 8th round, he became the new heavyweight champion of the world. And that was a boxing match that will most likely never be forgotten in the sporting world. And our passage today looks at another epic showdown, as we see two heavyweight gods being pitted against each other. You know, in the blue corner, we have weighing in at an impressive 450 prophets, we have Baal, the storm and fertility god, who bestows blessings upon man, who sends forth rain, who gives us blessings of soil and sends forth lightning and fire and gives grain, oil and wine. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Baal. And in the red corner, weighing in at only one prophet, we have the Lord, Yahweh, who rescued his people out of slavery through the Red Sea and brought them to himself. Ladies and gentlemen, the Lord. That's right, folks. Today, we will be watching an epic showdown of biblical proportions. And at the end, we'll all see who the real God is. But this is not just my God is bigger than your God. This is about true God versus false God. True religion versus false religion. True worship versus false worship. And true faith versus false or no faith. You know, we all live for something. Something is our God, you know, whether we're religious or we'd call ourselves an atheist. And we think that the thing that we're living for is what will deliver for us in the end. But if you have lived long enough, and I think everyone here has lived long enough to know that not all of these things will ultimately deliver. We'll find that after serving these gods all our lives, the promises they made were false. You know, for many of us here today, it might be our work, you know, whether at the office or in the home, that defines us. Perhaps we live to work, and we work such long hours because it gives us a sense of accomplishment or an impressive title that our friends and family are really proud of. Or maybe it provides us with financial security. Well, how would you feel if in 20, 30, 40 years, you find out that you've been slaving away only to find that the promises of work and wealth just don't deliver? Well, maybe we can use this New Year's Day to pause and to re-examine whether our energies, our time, our affections, our money are directed to the one who really can deliver. Now, before we look at today's passage, why don't we take a look at the times that we are in 1 Kings chapter 18, given we're jumping right into the middle of the book of 1 Kings. So Ahab, he was the king of Israel, which is the northern kingdom. And Ahab reigned during 874 to 852 BC. And if you flick back with me one page to chapter 16, verse 30, we'll see just what kind of king Ahab was. Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord, more than all who were before him. And as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, he took for his wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and went and served Baal and worshipped him. You know, something tells me Ahab probably didn't write this himself. Now, Israel, they've been in severe drought for about 3.5 years now. And it was the prophet Elijah who announced this drought. And so Elijah has been in the wilderness during this time. He's been hiding from King Ahab, who, with his wife Jezebel, was seeking to kill all of the prophets of the Lord. But in verse 1 of our passage today, we read that the drought is about to end. And Elijah is again to announce this. And it is God who is going to send the rain. And in very dramatic style, Israel will see that it is the real God that will bring about this end to the drought, not the false god Baal that they are also serving. And this brings us to our passage tonight, verse 17, and our first point, challenge false gods. So after Ahab was told that Elijah wished to see him, off Ahab went to meet Elijah. You know, Elijah, the one who Ahab believed caused the drought in Israel and made life so tough for his people. And so he greeted Elijah with an accusation. Is it you, you troubler of Israel? Now, the Hebrew word used here for trouble is not one that's commonly used in the Bible. One such place that it is used is Joshua chapter 6 and 7, and referring to Achan, who you may recall defied God's commandments when they entered the promised land and in front of all Israel was killed for his disobedience. So Ahab, with poison on his tongue, is accusing Elijah of having an infectious influence on his people. Now Elijah, being a not-so-meek and mild prophet, comes straight back at him. Now, I'm not sure how Elijah may have said this, but I imagine he would have thrown it right back in Ahab's face. I have not troubled Israel, but you have, and your father's house, because you have abandoned the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals. And now Elijah throws down the gauntlet and issues the challenge that will end in our epic showdown. Send and gather all Israel to me at Mount Carmel and the 450 prophets of Baal. So the challenge has been issued. Now the challenge is accepted. Ahab gathers all the people of Israel and the prophets, and they meet at Mount Carmel. Now, interestingly, Mount Carmel is a very significant place for Baal worship. So Elijah really has set up an epic showdown. The Baal prophets have the home advantage. They are on their home soil where Baal is strongest, and they filled the stadium with all of their supporters. And in verse 21, Elijah addresses Israel in what is our key verse. How long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. Elijah is leaving no room for lukewarm faith, for sitting on the fence, or for following both the Lord and Baal. Or as Andrew showed in that picture earlier, you can't have one foot on the punt and one foot on land. No, follow the one who is God. And at this point, it may be worth taking a slight step to the side to look at what may have lured Israel into worshipping Baal as a supplement to worshipping God. Or as Elijah puts it, for limping between two different opinions. Israel was an agricultural society, and Baal offered all the things that look attractive: rain, grain, and vines. If you kept Baal happy, you'd have good harvests. And in good times, Baal really did look like the god that you wanted to be in partnership with. And all the nations around them were worshipping Baal. Even Israel's king was worshipping Baal. So if they're worshipping Baal at the top, where all the power is, surely that's the right thing to do, isn't it? And I think for us today, how easy is it for us to worship what is around us as well, or perhaps instead of God? You know, our money and possessions, perhaps children and our family, work and careers. You know, there's countless self-help ideals out there and so-called religions that just don't require 100% commitment. These all cry out to us, and they are more attractive and alluring than we might think. And so what God is in your life that is or perhaps could be luring you away from worshipping the one true God? You know, is it a particular relationship? Is it your children or your family? Is it perhaps your reputation? Or is it your work? You know, Elijah's challenge to Israel is the same to us today. It doesn't matter what is attractive or what is appealing to us. It doesn't matter what everyone around us is doing. What matters is whether or not God is the real God. And if he is the real God, then we must follow him with all our heart, soul, and might. And if we think we can worship God but still have our hearts elsewhere, then we're just like the Israelites in this passage. We're limping between opinions. And if you're here today and you probably wouldn't consider yourself a Christian, or perhaps you do consider yourself a Christian, but if you're honest with yourself, you really give your heart somewhere else first, then I urge you to please re-examine where you're directing your hearts. Look into the claims in the Bible. Please don't bury your heads in the sand thinking that everything is fine. Because if God is truly God, then you must follow him wholeheartedly. Now back to our story. We're at verse 22. You know, the people, unsurprisingly, don't respond to Elijah's demand, not even a word. So Elijah sets out the rules of engagement. Elijah, the sole prophet of the Lord, versus the 450 prophets of Baal. Each corner is to take a bull and sacrifice it, cut it into pieces and lay it on some wood. But here's where it gets interesting. They're not to light the fire for the sacrifice. This part is for their respective god. They're each to call upon their god, and whichever one answers by fire and burns up the sacrifice, he alone is the real god. And the people now answer, "It is well spoken." They are all in favor. And Elijah lets the home team go first. They get to choose which of the two bulls they want themselves. He's not going to let them say afterwards that Elijah somehow rigged it, but somehow their bull was defective and that's why it didn't burn. You know, it's on their home ground, so Baal should be at his strongest, and they get to choose the best bull. So they've got all the advantages that go with being the home team. And in verse 26, they sacrificed their bull, cut it into pieces, and placed it on some wood, and called on the name of Baal. From morning until midday, they called out, "O Baal, answer us! O Baal, answer us!" And nothing. No voice, no reply. No one answered. And they limped around their altar. We're not told exactly what they were doing, but it seems some kind of ritual dance or movement, trying pathetically to invoke Baal into action. And at noon, Elijah had had enough. After seeing the prophets trying desperately to get Baal's attention, time after time after time, with no results, well, Elijah begins to mock them. "You know, cry louder. He's surely a god. You just need to shout a little louder in case he can't hear you. Maybe he's having a bit of a snooze. You know, keep going. Even gods need to spend a penny. He's probably in the loo. He'll be out any second now. Or maybe you missed the memo. He's on his annual leave. He's gone to the beach for some sun and sand." And then all mocking and joking stopped. Desperate to raise Baal, they began to cry and cut themselves until blood was gushing out of them. And I don't mean some small little cut across the finger and drops of blood on the ground. I mean, they're cutting themselves, stabbing themselves, so that blood was gushing out of them and on the ground. Well, midday passed them by, and they raved on, delirious with desperation and loss of blood. And again, nothing. No voice. No reply. No one answered. No one paid any attention. And of course nobody answered, for there is no such god as Baal. There is no such god as Baal. And this is no more relevant than for us today, living in such a multi-faith society. We need to remember that there is no such god as Baal, or whatever other name you want to give to the numerous false gods around. We are surrounded by false religions, false idols, false worship, and false ideals. And every now and then, if we're not careful, one of these could start looking quite attractive and tempting. But often, these false religions can also look just as ridiculous as the Baal prophets did. You know, such as the problems of the world being caused by the spirits of space aliens attaching themselves to our bodies. Yeah. Okay. I heard the other day of a monk in Asia who prays in a special river for several hours a day in order to cleanse his soul. You know, I'm not sure when he finds time to do some work and make a living. Well, perhaps it's okay to live off others in your quest for your own enlightenment. Or the thought that somehow a pilgrimage will bring you closer to God and invoke him to bless you or answer a particular prayer. You know, surely a living God isn't bound by geography. Or praying or saying mantras to a stone or to a statue or even a painting. I'm not sure if you noticed the last time you tried speaking to a stone or a statue, but they don't speak back, ever. Or if you leave some food for a painting or for a rock, it doesn't eat the food, it just goes rotten. Or perhaps closer to home within so-called Christian circles. Why worship non-living statues and icons instead of direct worship to the living God? Or the people who flocked to Coogee Beach in Sydney a few years ago, because apparently between 3 and 4 on a sunny afternoon, the reflection of light from a fence post looked a lot like the Virgin Mary. I mean, really? Yeah, I thought Australians were a bit beyond that, but I guess not. Or like the Baal worshippers, those Christian cults where they whip and cut themselves for their sins, as though it is pleasing to God. I mean, come on, guys. That's why Jesus was crucified on the cross. You know, this isn't pleasing to God. In fact, it's pitiful and it's perverse. And false gods, false religion, false worship. You know, a few years ago, we visited Fatima in Portugal, and we saw so many people walking on their knees praying on a long, hard marble path that must have been a few hundred meters long there and back. You know, and after we left the church, we went outside the dilemma of do we buy or do we not buy the 1 meter high glow-in-the-dark statues of Mary? You know, I suggested to Marcus that we could pick one up and put it on the front of the barge, but he wasn't really up for that. You know, I often joke about this, and in one sense it is right to, but frankly, it is also quite sad. And like the Baals, if your God, whatever that may be, is false, then you won't get an answer to your prayers or your pleas. And if your worship is false, then nothing you do can ever invoke your God into action, for it can't deliver what you want. So what is the God in your life that could be taking you away from the true God? You know, many of you work here in big companies that seem to think nothing of requiring you to serve them for almost every waking hour of the day, requiring you to sacrifice church and time away from family and friends. Or perhaps you're putting all your energy into a particular relationship or your family at the expense of your worship of God. Or are you too concerned about what people think about you, your reputation? How will you feel in however many years when you find out that that thing has been lying to you? That it can't really satisfy you? That it can't die for your sins? That it can't deliver you from death or give you any hope? This brings us to our second point. It's return to the true God. We're looking from verse 30. So after the complete failure of the Baal prophets to raise Baal, it is now Elijah's turn to step up and call on his God. He calls the people to come nearer to him, and he goes about repairing an old altar of the Lord that had been destroyed. You know, taking 12 stones, one for each tribe of Israel, not just the 10 tribes of the northern kingdom that were present, but the whole of Israel and Judah, all of God's people. He rebuilt the altar in the name of the Lord. And he then made a trench around the altar. And you can imagine the drama, just the tension, as the people wondered what on earth Elijah was doing. And then he laid the wood, he sacrificed the bull, cut it into pieces, and he laid them on the wood. And then in what I'm sure must have been to the complete bewilderment of everyone there, he ordered 4 jars of water to be poured over the bull and the wood. And then he ordered the water to be poured over the wood and the bull a second time. And then again a third time. And he seemed to be shooting himself in the foot, and sabotaging his own chances of success. How could it possibly burn if it has been absolutely soaked? Or, maybe as Elijah had intended, who could claim that Elijah had done some kind of trick and lit the bull himself if it was absolutely soaking wet? No, if it is going to be set on fire, it's not going to be by Elijah or any man. It will be by God. And then Elijah called on the name of his God in verse 36. A prayer of faith and confidence, knowing that he would answer. O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and that I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their hearts back. And look with me at verse 38 for what happened next. The fire of the Lord fell, and it consumed everything. The bull, the wood, the 12 stones, even the dust and the water that had collected in the trench. This was no man-made fire or some freakish lightning bolt that just happened to hit the right spot at the right time. This must be the fire of the Lord. And there weren't any fancy worship chants or dancing or bleeding needed to invoke the one true God. Elijah prays, fire falls, job done. And isn't this a great reminder that for true worship of the true God, we don't need any fancy worship as we serve God. We don't need to worry about whether the church is sufficiently decorated, or that we say chants and sing songs that are just absolutely perfect, or that everybody has made themselves sufficiently holy to be part of the service, or perhaps in our circles that we are being sufficiently evangelical. And none of these things in themselves are wrong, but they don't make God any more pleased with us, and they cannot possibly invoke God into action. No, like Elijah, we just need to come before our God faithfully, wholeheartedly, in true worship. And it is also helpful to see what true prayer looks like. Now, Elijah didn't make his prayer long-winded, puffing himself up or being overly pious in an attempt to invoke God into a response. As Christians, we can't manipulate God into doing what we want him to do, which many pagan prayers attempt to do. Rituals, sacrifices, cutting ourselves, praying on our knees on marble paths, they are empty prayers to an empty God. True prayer to the one true God is, in its very nature, simple. And God hears the prayers of those who are faithful. Elijah was confident of this, and so we can be confident of this. And do you remember in verse 24 how the people agreed that the God who answered by fire, he is God? Well, who is God? Verse 39, the Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. In God's mercy, the people recognized the true God, and they fell on their faces and worshipped him. The Lord, he is God, is what the people cried as they turned from idolatry and turned back to the one true God. And this is what we cry out as we turn our hearts from whatever idolatry is taking pride of place in our lives, and we turn our hearts back to God. As we read about Elijah winning a very unlikely victory, one man against many enemies, his sacrificed bull soaked through, his prayer reaching up to God. We remember another man who also won a very unlikely victory. Jesus Christ, one man against many enemies. Jesus Christ, who died on the cross in seeming defeat, but was actually a great victory. But unlike Elijah sacrificing the bull, Jesus himself was the sacrifice. Jesus' sacrifice was pleasing to God and enables people to come to him. Jesus, in his sacrifice on the cross, took on the penalty for the sins that we commit. And it is through Jesus' death and his resurrection that we can come to God in true worship. If we try to come to God by any other means other than through Jesus, then that is not true worship. If we pray to God, but we have not come to him through Jesus, then our prayers are not true prayers. True worship is worshiping the true God through his Son, Jesus Christ. But our story hasn't quite finished. There are still a few loose ends that Elijah needs to tidy up. And verse 39 seems to be quite severe, as Elijah seizes all 450 of the Baal prophets, takes them down the mountainside, and slaughters every one of them. It seems like it might be a bit over the top, like perhaps Elijah is acting out of anger or hatred towards the Baal prophets. But it's actually Elijah being completely faithful to the one true God. No need to turn to it now, but in Deuteronomy 13, it is very explicit that if a prophet says to the people to go after other gods and teaches rebellion against the Lord, then they are to be put to death. Elijah was to purge this evil from their midst, and that is exactly what he did. Harsh? Yes. Necessary? Absolutely. And we must have the same mindset as Elijah. We must put to death the idols and false gods in our lives that are luring us away from the one true God. This is severe language, but it is necessary. And with the help of the Holy Spirit, we are to put to death, to kill, to eradicate the things in our lives that are leading us away from God. God must take pride of place in our hearts. Nothing else has any power to save us, and therefore everything else must take a back seat. But if we can't keep it at bay and it keeps taking over, then put it to death like Elijah did to the Baal prophets. This will look different for each one of us, and it may mean taking some quite severe action. Perhaps changing jobs, maybe getting out of a particular relationship. Maybe changing that daily routine of yours. Perhaps addressing an imbalance in our priorities. These will not be easy steps to take, but it is necessary to take them. So why not spend some time soon in the new year discussing and praying about this with a close Christian friend or a family member or a spouse? Well, after putting the prophets to death, Elijah tells Ahab to go and eat, and after that to prepare his chariot to go back to Jezreel, for the rain that was promised by God will soon be on its way. And do you remember what I said at the start about the rain coming from God? Well, none amongst Israel would have thought that it was Baal who brought the rain. This whole showdown put that to rest. And as Ahab ate, Elijah prayed for rain. The clouds grew black and rolled in, and so too did the great rain. The showdown is over. The people have seen with their eyes that Baal was no god at all, that the Lord is God, the only true God, and God turned their hearts back to him. And as we hear from this part of God's word today, and as we start 2012, do you know that the Lord is the one true God? Are you worshipping the one true God wholeheartedly? Do you need to put to death any idols or ideals or false gods in your lives? So why not make your goal for this new year to follow the Lord, the only one who can deliver, and cry out, "The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God." Let's take a moment now to think about what we've heard tonight. And in a moment we'll stand and sing. If you look with me at the last verse of the song, it's a song about God who is the name above all names, who is worthy of all praise. And may our hearts sing, "How great is our God." Let's take a few moments first.